This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, from Nanjing to Cal Poly, a professor's journey.
The freedom of speech, the First Amendment. So it was a very difficult class. I almost failed.
Also, a UC Santa Barbara professor weighs in on changes in immigration policies.
Whatever Congress says around immigration is constitutional. So not even the Supreme Court would be able to challenge Congress on this.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 9th, 2024. I'm Meher Ali, an intern with Issues and Ideas. Today, I have two guests with me, Professor Cameron Jones, who is a history lecturer at Cal Poly, and Anthony Colin Herrera, a computer science master's student at Cal Poly. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The reason that I'm very excited today is that we're talking about some very interesting research that both of you have been involved in, which is about a very little-known community called the African Californios. So I'm going to start with Cameron, Professor Jones. Could you talk to us a little bit about who were the African Californios and why did you decide to do research on them?
My previous work was on frontier missions in Peru. And in about 2014, I decided to do some research down in the Santa Barbara Mission Archive Library. And I had noticed in my research about the missions in Peru that there were a lot of Africans and people of African descent in the missions that hadn't really been talked about. And being a native Californian, I was just curious. I asked the archivist, Monica Orozco, who is now the director of the Santa Barbara Mission, is this a project that is worth doing? And she looked at me and said, I've been waiting years for someone to do this project. So I was like, well, then I'm going to do this project. So who the African Californios are, when the Spanish came to California, they wanted to recruit people of European descent to come in to California, to settle California. But most people of European descent were part of the elite in Mexico. They didn't really want to move too far off California. And so the groups that they could convince to come, generally people of mixed ancestry, so both mixed European, indigenous, and African ancestry. And we found a lot of them are of African ancestry because in the Spanish Empire, there was a lot of Africans that got their freedom. They were manumitted. And they formed relatively large communities. But in the center of the empire, they were limited by the racial prejudice against them. Mm-hmm. In the frontier areas, the state was so desperate for settlers that they were willing to look past the fact that they didn't meet the kind of categories of the racial hierarchy, which they really wanted, and just kind of ignore the fact that they were people of color and come out here. So the people of African descent that come, census of 1790 has it at about 19% of the population identified either as being black, negro, or being of mixed race, so mulatto or pardo are the terms that they would use in the censuses. Some of them came to settle the first two communities of California, which are Los Angeles and San Jose. Some of them also were the soldiers in the Spanish army that came in. So if you specifically looking at San Luis Obispo, 1814, there's a census done of the non-indigenous population of California. And there's six soldiers here and their families. And five of the soldiers are identified as being of African descent.
Wow.
So of course, they stayed, most of them. And they ended up forming part of the elite. Many of them got ranchos after the Mexican period came in. And it culminates, really, the last Mexican governor of California was of African descent. Pio Pico, well known, I think, he was. But he didn't come from nothing, right? There was a pre-existing community. His family is a very large family. In fact, Rancho Piedras Blancas, which is just up the coast, or Hearst Ranch as we know it now, was owned by a Pico before it was sold to George Hearst in the, I believe, the 1860s. So this is a history that's all over California.
So that's so interesting. And we will get into Pio Pico a little bit later because you found interesting information about his family when you went to Virginia to present your research at the Digital Humanities Conference, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to turn to Anthony. How did you get involved with this project?
Yeah, so I was at a phase where I decided to do a master's degree, and I was always kind of close with Dr. Fuad Khoshmood. I took a natural language processing class, which is the study of language and computer science, and it was something I was really interested in. And after discussing with him about potential master's thesis, I wanted to make something that had to do with my Latin Hispanic background with computer science, like, you know, doing research into something that I felt like would be fulfilling and would be cool to look back on in the future. And he had a perfect project, African Californios, with Dr. Jones here. So we got connected, and it was something I was really interested in when he showed it to me.
So it kind of really fit well together. I wanted to go back to Cameron. Why are they called African Californios? You said that they were of African descent. Is it that they were brought in as slaves by the Spaniards? And your research focused on their history between 1769 to 1850, when California became a U.S. territory. But why start at 1769 and not earlier?
I mean, in a sense, the background of it is earlier. It's just 1769 is when the Spanish arrived in San Diego. So this is kind of considered the beginning of the Spanish conquest, to use lack of a better term, of California, invasion of California, right? That's invasion's a term we use in our field, but it gets called conquest sometimes. So the Spanish Empire had forcibly brought over Africans in vast numbers, probably over the entire span of the transatlantic slave trade, which is 1492 to 1868. Is the last slave ships that are coming to the Americas. The Spanish brought over about 2 million Africans, mostly in the Caribbean areas, which includes Mexico. So port areas, also the Pacific coast. So places like Veracruz, Acapulco on the west coast, Tampico, right? Coastal areas where they worked in plantations, and similar to what you see in the United States. The Spanish law was, because during the medieval period, the Spanish always had slavery. So in Northern Europe, slavery ended in the medieval period. So when the British are bringing enslaved people over, they kind of have to like reinvent the law code about slavery. And that's why you get in British law, enslaved peoples are considered property, period. In Spanish law, it's more complicated because of this longer tradition of enslavement. And it's not necessarily better or worse, to be clear with that. This allowed for more people to be freed because the Spanish laws were such. In the Spanish system, enslaved peoples were owned, but because they're baptized Catholics, they had rights as Catholics, mm-hmm. right? So they had the right to get baptized. They had the right to get married. Marriage was sacred, right? That's not saying there weren't abuses in the system, and especially in kind of rural areas where there wasn't as much monitoring by ecclesiastical authorities or state authorities. So what you get throughout colonial Latin America is larger free black, free African communities. So they're there multiple generations. They marry into the indigenous population. They marry into the European population. And so what you're seeing in California is generally people who are kind of third or fourth generation people of African descent. There's actually very few people who are labeled as, well, no one's labeled as African. Very few people are labeled as black, mm-hmm. right? Most are of mixed ancestry. The title comes from, you need to have a short URL for the website, like people of African descent in California is just too long. Mm-hmm. But they are Africans. Their ancestry comes from Africa. And interestingly, some of them, if asked, wouldn't necessarily acknowledge that. The term that they always use when asked what their, now race wasn't a term they used. They would use either caste or quality. Calidad, they would say we're gente de razón, people of reason, meaning that they're Catholic and they speak Spanish. That would separate them from the native Californians, the Chumash and the, you know, the Tonga and the other groups in California, because they were aiding in the Spanish colonization of the native population. I mean, they in some ways were the enforcers for Spanish colonialism. So it's complicated in that way. They are trying to overcome racial disparities that they would have encountered in Mexico. But at the same time, to do that, they became enforcers of the colonial order. And, you know, and there's a reason they become some of the richest people in California, because they're able to take advantage of the native population. So it creates a very complicated way of looking at the mission system, the early settlements in California, and eventually the rancho system that develops here.
Anthony, I want to go back to what you said about how you were interested in doing something that combined computer science with your heritage. Could you expand on that? And then also, what role does computer science have in this research?
Yeah, so my background, my mother immigrated from Guatemala, and I grew up in the Central Valley. I grew up in Bakersfield. So a lot of Hispanic upbringing, a lot of, you know, somewhat difficulty getting higher education, coming to Cal Poly. I kind of hit a point where when I was thinking about my master's thesis, I really wanted to connect with something that involved my background, right? Like something that I'd be interested in, you know, and interested in some of the discoveries we can make with the research that I'm doing with my thesis. So especially with African Californians, I thought it was really cool. It's something I never thought of, but once you see the data and you talk to Dr. Jones, it's like really interesting to learn about who these people were and what they were doing. And when it comes to computer science in this research, a lot of automating. So a lot of the tools and automations I'm doing would normally require a lot of hands-on, time-consuming work. So we're looking into using a lot of natural language processing, a lot of algorithmic thinking, and using computers to do things a lot more quickly and see how well that works.
Could you give us an example of how computer science played into this project?
So Dr. Jones was able to acquire a lot of census data from multiple years of Spanish records. And normally when you're matching people between those records, which is something we're really interested in, to see how the census and how the population changed over time, that requires a lot of manual time for multiple people to probably sit there and really go through and analyze by hand. So we're using computer science to automate that, so to be able to use algorithms and different methodologies to match names and places and birth dates and racial and ethnic records to create those matches a lot more quickly and hopefully with a lot more assurance.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking to Professor Cameron Jones and Cal Poly student Anthony Herrera about their research on African Californios. I understand that you generated family trees, mm-hmm. digitized census records, and interactive visualizations. So actually, maybe Professor Jones, do you want to tell us a little bit about the larger goal of this project?
So as Anthony was mentioning, we have a lot of disparate records on people in California or settlers in California and soldiers during this time period. But the biggest record we have is something called the Early California Populations Project, the ECPP. It was a big database put together by a professor down at UC Riverside, Stephen Hackle. Just the baptismal records have over 100,000 names, right? So it's a huge database. But for whatever reason, and this is a little bit of a mystery that I've been playing with, the missionaries, the priests who are recording these, it's baptisms, which essentially births or conversions, marriages, and burial records, the three records, main records they have. They didn't put race in there, which was actually not normal. And in Mexico, it's actually quite normal when a baby's born for the priest to identify the race. Now, given these things are not they're not really a science, so they're never precise. And it was a lot this kind of the opinion of the priest or whoever is there. But when we do research, say, in Mexico, we have those records. California doesn't have that racial identification. Where race is actually identified is in the censuses we have. So several censuses of Los Angeles, of San Jose, and then there's the general census of the entire colony of California in 1790. And so I was looking at all this data, and I was like, I could do this, but it's like a lifetime of work, right?
Yeah.
And so this is where Dr. Kosmoud, who's my research partner and the advisor of Anthony, came in. We were connected by a good friend of ours, Greg Domber, who's also in the history department. He said, how about you go talk to Fawad and see what he can do? Because he's an expert on natural language processing, which matching names is part of that. And so we recruited Anthony and some others to create a database of these people of African descent. Because you could see their names in the census, but you couldn't match them. And if you can match them to the birth records, now you have their parents, you have their children, because you can follow them through the birth records, right? So you have a bigger picture of the families that are of African descent. And so then we took that data and we turned it into family trees. So the reason we used African descent as kind of a general term is because we don't know how these people were identified, but we can tell that they have some African ancestry. And this has been acknowledged even by some of the leaders, like the Picos, that they have African ancestry. But we wanted to see, you know, how many people? Where are they? Do they form, you know, separate communities, or are they integrated? Either way is very interesting for us. And so this was kind of the impetus to bring in computer science experts to help us to sort through all that data. So this is what we've been doing.
Anthony, how long did it take you to work with this database?
I've been working on it for, I'd say, more than a year now. But it's been an on and off situation just because I'm a student, so I have to focus on classes. And
is there like some kind of algorithm that you've developed to process the data quicker?
So I did develop a name matching algorithm, and then I developed an algorithm to create family trees. So that's what I've been working on the past little over a year.
And is that what your master's thesis is about?
So my master's thesis is still not like definitive, but it's mostly going to be based on creating those family trees, as well as using a book of California land grants to match the names that are in there with the names that I matched previously from the records that Dr. Jones has.
So your focus is on developing these algorithms that would make it easier to process data?
Yeah, almost like a framework for historian experts to use.
That sounds really, really useful, actually, even for the public.
Well, yeah, so the goal is to create like visualizations that are very public-friendly, public-facing. Mm-hmm. So he was talking about the land grants. There actually isn't a map of all the California land grants, I mean, apart from African Californias. So we're matching these African Californias to their land grants. There's lists of the land grants, but there's no map. And we're hoping to build a comprehensive map of all the land grants, but then identify which ones were owned by African Californians. You know, because I can describe all these things, but if it's not accessible, then it doesn't matter, right? This is one of the problems I think professional historians have had, particularly the last few decades. We lament that people don't know enough history, but then we write books that are very hard for the public to understand. So part of this project is having a public-facing website, the AfricanCalifornians.org, with visualizations that are very easy for people from, well, hopefully from, you know, fourth grade, which is when they learn about California, to any age above that, right? So building maps, family trees, things that people can move around and look at pictures and match people to each other, because that's going to be a lot more approachable than, you know, me writing a book about it where I describe all of this. And the computer science team has taught me a lot. There's been times where I've written something on the website and Dr. Kosmoud Fawad looks at it and goes, that's too many words. You need to put less words in there. And he's like, can you put a picture? Because the people like the pictures and people will actually look at it. And he's right. So having Anthony on there looking at it, you know, how do we present this type of situation is very helpful for me.
And Anthony, what is something that you have learned or been fascinated by during your research process?
Yeah, so something I've learned and been fascinated about is how interconnected some of the families are. So, for example, like one name that always pops up in any record is Pico. And even when we were at the Smithsonian U.S. History Museum, there was a portrait and little snippet about Pio Pico. So it's like someone that I probably heard of, or maybe I was driving down like in L.A. I think there's like a Pico.
There's a Pico Boulevard. And I think there's an elementary school as well.
Yeah. And it's like just seeing this name and like not even Pio Pico, but his family members pop up throughout the generations and throughout the records, I've found really interesting.
African Californians, you mentioned, settled in San Luis Obispo County. Cameron, could you talk to us a little bit about that, as well as whether there were any other communities along the Central Coast?
I mentioned earlier, one of Pio Pico's cousins owned Rancho Piedras Blancas. He also had a home in San Luis Obispo. He was known by nickname Totoy Pico. He actually was involved in this kind of interesting event where he had been fighting in the Mexican-American War. He had been fighting for the Californios against the U.S. He was captured and then put on parole, which meant he couldn't join the fight again. Like, he was sent home, essentially. But then he did. And so Fremont, when he got here, John C. Fremont, into San Luis Obispo, he arrested him and tried him and sentenced him to be hanged in front of the mission. There is a little bit of discrepancy on what happens next. I mean, the nice romantic thing is that his wife came and begged Fremont to release her husband. And that actually did happen. That was, people saw that. And then so he actually commuted the sentence. And so he was not hanged. I suspect, and other historians suspect, this was part of a deal because Fremont knew when the U.S. eventually took over California, he needed people like the Pico family on his side.
Oh.
Right? So he knew that he had to have a show that, oh, you shouldn't do that. But so it's one of the more dramatic moments in early San Luis Obispo history.
Yeah.
But through the Central Coast, Santa Barbara had a presidio, a fortress. And so, as I've said, many of the soldiers were of African descent. In the Spanish Empire, free blacks actually participated quite a bit in militias throughout the colonial period. So there's kind of an association with people of African descent and the military within Spanish America, within the Spanish Empire. So when the Spanish Empire opens up the regular army for colonial subjects, most of the soldiers and non-commissioned officers are of African descent. A lot of them are,
okay.
Right? More than most people have acknowledged up to this point. So Santa Barbara was probably hosting a good number. When we've mapped this out kind of preliminarily, most people of African descent actually concentrated in the Los Angeles area, which is where Pio Pico lived and worked. The Pueblo of Los Angeles, right, the town, and then you have north, you have Mission San Fernando in near Los Angeles, Mission San Gabriel, San Luis Rey in Oceanside, and then San Diego de Alcalá in San Diego, right? Those are the four missions, because we are seeing the baptismal record. So they lived outside of those areas, but those were the places they were bringing their children to be baptized and to go get married. So that's how, you know, we can track these individuals. But it's interesting, because Southern California tended to be kind of a focus of people of African descent, less so in Northern California.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I'm just thankful for Dr. Jones and Dr. Kosnud for giving me this opportunity. I feel like being able to present and be co-published is something that I never thought would happen for me. So I'm very thankful for that. I'm very appreciative.
Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that I haven't asked?
Sure. I grew up in San Luis Obispo. I learned about the California missions as a young man. And, you know, my teacher did a great job teaching me. But when they taught the missions, it was very one-sided or maybe two-sided, right? And I'm hoping, you know, one of our goals here in this project is to show how complicated it is. I mean, in no way to diminish the suffering of the native Californians, nor the many cruel acts that the Spanish perpetuated here and later the Mexican government, but also recognizing that there are lots of different groups and the issues that we have here in California stem from larger systemic racism. And so these aren't things that are, you know, they happened 100 something years ago, but I think we can take lessons from them that we can apply today, where you can look at individual acts, but when you look at the total, you can see the acts are a result of a systemic form of racism. So that's one of our goals of this project.
Thank you, Professor, for coming in. Thank you for your time and explaining in great detail about your research project, which is really important in terms of filling in a huge gap in our history. I was just talking to Professor Cameron Jones and Cal Poly student Anthony Herrera. If you'd like to learn more about their project, you can visit africancalifornios.org. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. From Nanjing to Cal Poly, Professor Yan Shan shares her incredible journey.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Yan Shan, Associate Professor of Journalism at Cal Poly State University. She shares fascinating stories of her family life in China, her university studies there, and cultural nuances that are distinctive from daily life in America.
So you grew up in a small town.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in Anhui province.
It was an agricultural village?
It's actually a village, you know, because of railway.
Oh, okay.
It become much more developed. Mm-hmm. So I would describe it as a transportation center,
sure.
Like a hub.
You know, I was in Ningbo years ago, and Ningbo is called a village.
Yes.
And it's like 4 million. And I go, that doesn't make sense. And, village has to denote of what it does, not its size.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely have a very different definitions of village versus city in China. So my hometown, I would describe it as very like industrial because mm-hmm. of the railway and the transportation. Now, like everything is
electric and speed train.
But now it still serves as a, you know, the transportation hub mm-hmm. from city to city. Yeah, so that's where I grew up.
And both your mom and your dad were college graduates, right?
Yes.
Professors, or what did they do?
Yeah, my father taught economics, and my mother, she is a physician. She works at the health center on campus. I actually grew up on a college like environment. Mm-hmm. So maybe somehow that's why I chose to be a professor in mm-hmm. America, you know, because this is how I grew up. When I was little, I was observing my father teach classes and interacting with students. So maybe that mm-hmm. planted a seed on my mind. I wanted to be a professor or teacher.
So your parents grew up in the apex of the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
So that was the day of the Red Guard and a lot of ugly episode in China in a lot of respects. Did they ever tell you stories and talk about their time growing up?
Yeah. What's interesting is I've had some deep conversation with my father. He was willing to share more. And from my mother, we have a very brief conversation. They have pretty different experiences during that Cultural Revolution because they are in different places.
Mm-hmm.
So my father, he grew up in Tianjin. You know, it's a very big city. It's next to Beijing. It's very industrial. It's much more developed. So the social movement at that time, especially during the Cultural Revolution, that the Red Guard, I would describe it's more active. It was much more active. A lot of things happened.
But there was a lot of momentum in the rural communities at that time, right?
Yeah.
So your mom was too young, but there was Mao Zedong came up with the whole barefoot doctors.
Mm.
I knew a Chinese woman who grew up there during that time. She went to med school like in England and was forced to go back and become tutor under a barefoot doctor. Yeah, so that did not happen to your mother.
No, my mother, she grew up in a very small town, like countryside mm-hmm. of China. You know, like the town have a very small population. At that time, she was small. Like she was eight or nine.
Yeah, yeah.
So she barely know what happened. A lot of things she heard from my grandpa. I mean, according to her description, at that little age, like she know, like sometimes it was dangerous to go outside. But most of the time, she felt, you know, fine and safe. But for my father's side, like my father, he was able to tell me a little bit more about what happened in Tianjin and the Red Guard, like, gathered together. So for my parents, it really depends on where they were. And they have drastically different experiences.
Yeah. Just like you had very drastically different
experiences for me. Yeah.
So by the time you entered university, China was really opening up and blossoming as a world player.
Yeah, I was in college from 2005 to 2009, and I majored in journalism. I think I wanted to study journalism to be a storyteller. Like, I really wanted to, you know, be able to record what happened. So I decided to study journalism. I think my concentration at that time was production. Yeah, so...
In what medium did you work in?
Primarily, overtraining at that time was to, like, traditional, like, legacy media, like so television,
print and TV.
A little bit radio, but primarily TV at that time was the new media. Internet was started, like, you know, we started to learn how to work with computers and stuff. But there was no social media at that time. So, you know, internet was still, like, relatively new.
So as an undergraduate, in your mind, did you think you would just stay where you were in that region?
Yeah, that was a plan. After I graduated, I worked in Nanjing TV station.
Oh, cool.
You know, it's a local station, but it's big enough to produce its own show.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked at the one of the, you know, like assistant producer for a, they have these like late, not necessarily late night show, but it's a show broadcast from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. primarily cover like local stories.
Mm-hmm. Features.
Yeah, like feature stories, mm-hmm. you know, everyday life here in Nanjing. And we primarily focusing on the education news. And there are some stories that we do on a regular basis, like college admission exam, which is a big deal in China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my focus becomes slightly into education. Yeah, it was a very, very like interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have both experiences in print and experiences in TV production. Mm-hmm. So that taught me a lot.
But yeah. Something happened. There was a shift. Your horizons widened. What was it? What tempted you?
Yeah, I think for me, I always have this urge, you know, I wanted to see what other country practiced journalism or storytelling. I think that always what I kind of dream of. When I was in college, we were still have access to New York Times, like the English version, and Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to the library and I would read all the newspaper in English. And that's something I always enjoyed doing when I was in college. So I think I always have this desire to explore what other country practice journalism. I was exposed to a lot of, you know, journalistic storytelling from New York Times and Wall Street Journal. So I think definitely America would be the place that I wanted to go.
Were there a lot of similarities, though, culturally, in how you produced and what you focused on?
Some similarities. I mean, the technical stuff, mm-hmm. like the style of writing, you know, how you work with the equipment and gears, the technic stuffs are similar. But the mentality, like the way you approach a stories, or even thinking about as a reporter or journalist, who I'm writing for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that question is very different.
Did you feel any cultural, political pressure to conform within certain parameters?
At that time, I didn't necessarily feel a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
When I decided that I wanted to apply to school in America, I talked to my parents, I talked to the friends, my professor at that time, they were all very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I worked in the TV station, at that time, my producer, who was a senior producer, and she shadowed me a lot. And she actually encouraged me to do that.
Mm-hmm. How did you target where you wanted to go and what you wanted to do in America?
Before I decided that I wanted to apply to a school here in America, at that time they were doing a lot of educational expo in Nanjing. So what they do, like it's like an event or conference, and they invite a lot of American college, their admission office, to come to China and to, you know, to have a table, have a station.
For recruiting?
For recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually went to several events. It was in downtown Nanjing. It was very fancy. I was able to connect with someone from University of Central Florida. I still remember his name. His name is Mark. And we had this very fascinating conversation. He introduced me to the journalism school at UCF. So, you know, like we talked about my experiences and what makes me qualified to, you know, to apply to the program.
This was a graduate program?
Yeah, this mm-hmm. is a graduate program. That was kind of open, like a potential window yeah. or door. Yeah, that was, you know, just opportunity after opportunity. Like it's, I don't know, like somehow it lead me to my way to America.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. Correspondent Tom Wilmer talks with Cal Poly professor Yan Shan about her journey from her childhood in China.
So I end up going to UCF. They have a graduate program in journalism and mass communication. So I studied there for 2 years. You know, I absolutely had a fantastic time there. It's a program that combine like practical as well as like that theoretical that you need, because for me, I have to relearn so much about journalism, the paradigm shift about journalism, you know, because when I was in college, we were over curriculum more focusing on telling stories that would fit into a specific political narrative. But here in America, we were taught that journalism was supposed to serve the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that time, it took me a while to grasp that idea about, like, who are the public? Mm-hmm. You know, who are we serving?
Right.
I think that kind of set up the foundation for me to learn what actually is journalism, how that different compared to what I was taught about journalism mm-hmm. in China. So, yeah.
So when you graduated, then what?
At that time, you know, when I graduated, I feel like I still need to learn more. I mean, there's so much that I feel like I didn't know or I didn't learn, especially about, you know, like I remember I took a class when I was at UCF is, you know, media law and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about the three pillars of America politics. They talk about the freedom of speech, the First Amendment. So it was a very difficult class. I almost failed.
Wow.
But I just feel like there's so much that I do not know mm-hmm. at that time. So at that time, one of my professors said, why don't you apply to a doctoral program to learn more? I said, okay, I will give a try. So she recommended a few programs. I end up going to University of Georgia. I think one of the things I decided to kind of slightly change my trajectory is the storytelling and creative aspect of that. I think that connect to some of the fundamental that I learned is about how do you tell a story, or how do you craft your message. So that's something I feel like I haven't been able to have a lot of experiences. Mm-hmm. I wanted to learn more.
Yeah. But how did you wind up in academia?
When I was at Georgia, I fall in love with teaching. Never thought I would be interested in teaching. But I just love to be able in the classroom and kind of share my experiences and perspective with, you know, my students.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I don't actually consider they're my student. I think we're learning together,
right.
Especially, you know, in media. And I feel like teaching would be the job that I will never get tired of. Cal Poly, it's a very interesting path from the East Coast to the West Coast, right? Before I came to Cal Poly, I had no knowledge or experiences of exposure of California. California sounds like a beautiful state, but it's so far away mm-hmm. from me. I saw there was an opening here in the journalism program, and the class they listed like fit exactly with my experiences. I've taught these classes before, mm-hmm. so I decided to give a try.
And what year was that?
That was early 2016.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've been here for a while, though.
Yeah.
I still, like, even it have already been 8 years, I still remember vividly, like, the day I visited SLO mm-hmm. and Cal Poly. The day I landed in SLO, it was the first week of January. It was stormy. It was raining. I landed at the local airport, somehow I was in shock. Like, this is not the California I was envisioning, like, you know, because I was thinking about California, like palm trees, like sunny beach. But after I came to, like, took a tour of the program and meeting folks here in the program, and Professor Mary Glick was still the chair at that time. So
she retired recently, right?
Yeah. She
Glick.
Mary Glick. So I immediately feel like something clicked. I think primarily because it's a very warm, supportive department. Everyone was super friendly. Everyone was super supportive. And another thing was appealing to me at that time is the curriculum itself, like the learn by doing approach. Mm-hmm. Because I was a firm believer that I can't learn if I'm not practicing these skills.
Right.
So I immediately felt like there was a click. And I also had conversation with students. I love the student media that we have. It's very practical oriented. The students are very hands-on, and they're very eager to learn. So that's something I love about the school.
Are you able to cherry pick some classes that you enjoy the most?
I think I've enjoyed all the classes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite closest to your heart?
It's hard to pick. I absolutely love all the classes. But if I had to pick a class, I would say it's a senior practicum class that I started to teach a couple of years ago. It's a small class with 20 students. Every quarter, we worked on a campaign or like a project.
Mm-hmm. And what's the theme, the breadth of themes that you can take on?
Yeah, the overarching theme is to serve as a PR support for student media. Like, mm-hmm. whatever Mustang Media Group is doing or planning to do or have the needs.
So it might be print or it might be radio.
Yeah, might be audience engagement, might be social media, might mm-hmm. be events. So the overarching goal is to support the PR operation of student media.
So you're still doing PR?
Yeah. Every quarter is slightly changed, mm-hmm. the, you know, exactly what we do. The nuances that we do change slightly, but the goal remain the same.
Do you classes from freshman up to fourth year?
Sort of. The classes I teach right now mm-hmm. are primarily geared towards upperclassmen. So there are some classes I had freshmen or I had second years. The practicum class I was discussing earlier, primarily, like, everyone in that class are seniors. So they're graduating senior. So if I had to pick a class, I would say, you know, the senior practicum class.
How does your background, your history, being an international person, how does that dovetail to what you teach the kids? Because you have a different history and a different worldview than they do.
That's a fantastic question. I reflect and thought about that question a lot. I think my international background, I think I bring that diverse perspective to the classroom. Sometimes I feel like our student, they may see the world in a certain way. I feel like it's my job and my responsibility to help them see things from a different perspective mm-hmm. or exposed to things from different perspectives.
And how receptive are they? Do you ever see that kind of wow moment?
Yeah, sometimes. So, like, for example, like the advertising class I teach, I show them a McDonald's ad that I saw when I was little. It's the first McDonald's ad in China in Mandarin. It was aired in 1998, way before they were born. And it just kind of opened their mind about how things have changed or how you have to adapt your content, your message to different audiences, mm-hmm. right?
Contextually, time and place.
Yes. So we had extensive discussions. Like, if you wanted to connect to you know, a different groups of audiences, may share different worldview, may speak different languages, may practice different, you know, rituals, or how would you able to find that human component that would connect with them? So I think that's something I thought a lot. I feel like my experiences, my perspective as an international faculty, be able to connect with them. And also, I feel like this generation of students have a much wider worldview because of social media and internet. And so I think they're more willing to accept, you know, like this idea about connecting with different audiences, with different groups.
So you've been on the other side of the world for quite a while now. Your mom and dad are still alive, and so it follows that you probably are able to return home once in a while to visit the family?
Yeah. I visited China last year in 2023. I spent most of my time in my hometown to primarily visiting my grandpa, who is still alive and 19-2 and going strong.
Nice.
You know, like, the purpose for me to visit back to China is primarily to see him as frequently as I can. And because COVID have shut down everything, so I wasn't able to travel back in 3 years. And so it was nice to be able to go back and visit him.
What are the most striking changes and evolutions or devolutions in China that you've noticed since you left?
Oh, yeah. That's... Where are I going to start? I think the immediate change that I saw, like, is they are no longer using the physical money anymore. Like, everything is on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Last year when I visited home, I still bring cash with me.
But they go, what's that?
Like, what's that? Like, no, I'm not going to touch that, right?
Yeah, so, I think I tried to use a yuan in the shop, and they're going, what's that for?
Yeah, and like even if you go, like the ticketing, right? Mm-hmm. You go to the train station, they don't give you a physical ticket anymore. You just scan your ID or you just scan your phone. That was definitely an immediate shock to me.
Because that wasn't operative when you were in college there at all.
Yeah, so like even the, you know, the time when I left, even before COVID, I was able to travel back and forth much more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, people were still using cash or credit card or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But now, like, everything is, you know, like, QR code. QR code and you pay. And that was just kind of, you know, immediate reaction that I had. I don't know. I have mixed thought about it. So in some way, I love the convenience of it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, it doesn't seem as inclusive. Yeah. Like, what if you are someone who just, you know, don't have a phone, or if you're just someone that you are, like, you're a foreigner, you're a traveler, you don't necessarily have a, you know, a phone in China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, I don't know, thinking about my grandpa, who is 19-2, like, he doesn't know how to scan our QR code and pay.
Yeah.
So, wow, that was very, very different compared to, like, even 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, everything is so new, like, fancy, like, in China now. Like, the airport is just fancy, like, everything is fancy.
And, like, that bullet train to Shanghai Airport.
Yeah, like, the bullet train.
200 miles an hour.
Totally, yeah. It feels so different now, I mean.
But we talked the other day about ancient towns in China, and you can still go off that beaten path. I've been in villages where no cars could get in.
Yeah.
Because the roads were built for donkeys, and it was too narrow.
Yeah.
So you can still go back in time in China.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely certain places you can still have that little village where, you know, you have to travel by foot or just, you know, by horse or something.
Yeah.
But my concern is, like, these places are shrinking. Places will be more difficult to find.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they become kind of Disneylands of sort.
Yeah.
You know, they can't be viable producing communities
because
of transportation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But thankfully, some of them are still there.
Yeah.
And thank you, Yan.
That was correspondent Tom Wilmer speaking with Cal Poly professor Yan Shan about her journey from China to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, KCSB student reporter Ashley Sigat talks with UC Santa Barbara professor Alfredo Gonzalez about what immigration policies could look like under the Trump administration.
So my first question is, you've written about the historical development of U.S. immigration policies and their impact on the immigrant communities, particularly Latina and Latino communities. How do you see Trump's approach to immigration fitting into the broader historical trajectory of the U.S. political development, especially in terms of racialized citizenship?
It's not anything new, right? We have seen this before. We have seen different phases and stages of politicians using immigrants as scapegoats to gain power, win elections. So this isn't anything new. It's different, but it's not new. What was the second part of the question?
How will it affect communities in terms of racialized citizenship and what we will see coming out of this presidency following?
Yeah. So I think it's definitely renewed fears in immigrant communities. There's work by sociologists at UCLA, Lacey Abrego and Cecilia Menjivar, who have studied this idea of legal violence. They've conceptualized this idea of legal violence, which is essentially a way of the state to establish different ways of policing communities, inflicting violence on communities, and it being totally okay because it was passed by a legislature and it's being enforced by the people in these different agencies. But legal violence is also stretching to these communities, not in a physical way, but also in a psychological way, where these communities are feeling violence every day upon themselves, just being scared, you know, fear that someone is going to disrupt their lives, might potentially forcibly remove them, is causing a lot of anxiety in these communities. So that is something that we are going to see, and we're starting to see. At the same time, there's been other work by another really great scholar, Inez Valdez, who's at Johns Hopkins, and she writes about reframing immigration politics. And she thinks about it in a different way, legal violence, that is, and says that we should start from the point of how the state approaches people that are here without authorization and how the state deals with them, whatever violence they are going to inflict on them, as being appropriate. We should start from there. And if we start from there, then we can see and assess whether or not that violence is actually excessive. So instead of starting from a place where we're going to say no one should experience violence for being here without authorization, that's not what she's saying. She's saying that we should get that out of our heads. If someone breaks the law, you're going to want them to be brought to justice, right? If someone were to break into your home, if someone were to assault you, would you not want them to feel or experience some kind of punishment for doing those things? The same thing with folks that are here without authorization. So it's unrealistic to go about our days thinking that immigrants who are here without authorization as victimless crimes, right? In some ways that might be the case, but in other ways, they are breaking the law. And at the end of the day, when people break the law, especially if we are a country of laws, then we should expect migrants who are here without authorization to experience some kind of punishment. What that punishment is should not be excessive, right? We shouldn't be separating families at the border. That's excessive. That's inflicting trauma on children, unnecessary trauma on children, simply to deter people. That would be an example of excessiveness, right? Turning them away at the border, that might be appropriate. So these communities are feeling a lot of different anxieties, and they're going through trauma right now. And I do think that this administration is going to inflict even more punishment and trauma. We need to be ready to assess to what extent it's excessive.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. KCSB student reporter Ashley Segat talks with UC Santa Barbara professor Alfredo Gonzalez about what immigration policies will look like under the Trump administration.
How do you see his policies continuing to shape the future of Latino immigrant populations, especially when we're talking about national security, citizenship, and deportation risk, and the potential excessive punishment for entering the country illegally?
These next 2 years are going to really shift how we think about immigration, because it looks like the Republicans have won the House and they have control of the Senate. So this means that basically whatever kind of policy that they want to pass around immigration, they're going to be able to. So as long as the majority of those in the House are willing to create an excessive policy around immigration, that's going to be the purview of the state. And the unfortunate part is that we don't get to say if immigration policy that was passed by Congress is excessive. They get to say that, right? So immigration policy is that one area that has no checks and balances. Everything else in government has checks and balances except immigration naturalization. Congress enjoys plenary power over immigration. So if they pass a policy or a bill that is going to be oppressive, that is going to mandate different enforcement agencies across the country to deputize even more enforcement agencies to engage in immigration work, that will happen. We are at that cusp right now. It is very likely. It wouldn't take the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has already ruled previously in the 19th century that whatever Congress says around immigration is constitutional. So not even the Supreme Court would be able to challenge Congress on this. So I'm not worried about the president, because all he's going to do is sign. I'm worried about Congress and what they're planning.
That was just a brief preview of the conversation I had with Assistant Professor Gonzalez on the implications of immigration policies on marginalized communities within the U.S., especially the Latinx population, and the ways that these policies have deepened political polarization, especially among Latinx and immigrant populations. This is Ashley Segat with KCSB News. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.